Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I am joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Adam Francisco as we continue to comment on the Chronicles of Narnia. We've been going in the order that they're written, so this should be episode 5 of this, right? And we are reading The Horse and His Boy. The Thinking Fellows is part of the 1517 podcast network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of the shows there. The 1517 website is more than just podcasts. You can check out a daily blog there. You can check out helpful articles that go through the lectionary every week if you are a pastor to help prepare for preaching. That is called The Craft of Preaching on our website. You know, I've sold this Craft of Preaching on my other podcast, Outlaw God Podcast, a bunch by noting that it isn't sermons. So if you were trying to try to rip off The Craft of Preaching as your total sermon for the week, you would only have a 4-minute sermon. And maybe some of your parishioners would like that, but really...
That doesn't sound horrible.
I'll go to your church. Yeah.
But really what it is to help give you some conversation partners throughout your week as you do your sermon prep. You know, if you read through the text alone every week, this maybe gives you somebody else's ideas to converse with and to consider as you're preparing your preaching. So go ahead and check those out or any of the other resources at 1517.org. Okay, guys, so The Horse and His Boy, this is a continuation of, there's like, at this point, a couple of types of books, I think. We have sort of like the main saga with the Pevensey children, and then we have a sort of the imaginings of what happens when the Pevensey children aren't there, but then also some stories of just the happenings of Narnia. And I think this sort of
They do make an appearance.
They do make an appearance.
Two appearances.
Edmund makes the biggest appearance, and he's...
And Susan.
And Lucy.
At the end.
But I think Edmund gets the most screen time, shall we say.
Most talky-talky.
In the book. And he's kind of a badass in this book, I got to say.
He's kind of a rock star. That cracked me up that when Lewis sort of goes over to the dialogue between Edmund and Susan, he all of a sudden dips into Shakespearean English for an entire chapter. And what thou dost do, thy sister. And I was like, okay.
But so. But they are overall side characters. And this is really an expansion of what we would, you know, sort of like in TV and literature today say the universe of Narnia, right? It's really kind of filling in the map and the happenings. I think between Silver Chair and this, it really makes me want a map as I'm putting everything together.
Interesting, this one.
I'm rereading it for whatever time. And it's now in this volume where I'm starting to get a mental map. I'm like, okay, north is Narnia, south is Kellerman, Archenland. And then we got a chronology too. We're like in the 11th century in Narnia time, right? And which I don't know because I've not done the work. And Scott, one question I've wanted to ask you all along is just like, if do you have this whole narrative in your head?
No,
it seems like you do.
Maybe no. I mean, this is in the high time of Narnia. This is.
It parallels, I don't know, because again, I've not done the external research or read the secondary sources, but so much of this feels like the beginning of the, what historians call the High Middle Ages. Even the Kellerman, the people of Kellerman, they feel like Central Asian people. The names seem very Central Asian, Turkic names. And it doesn't parallel it.
Well, they have scimitars and
turbans. They feel like Seljuk Turks to me.
Yeah,
The people who invaded the Eastern Mediterranean that, and as a result, sparked the Crusades and so on.
When you get the allusion to the fact that they're much more numerous people than the people of Arkenland or the people of Narnia, that that they think that if they were to raise a big enough army, they could pretty handily
just take
both of those lands. Although the king is a little wary of that prospect, more so than the prince.
They tell stories about Aslan there.
Yeah.
And they're a little afraid of him. Yeah. they think they can take Narnia unless Aslan were to get involved.
Yeah, and then it'd be all over.
Yeah, which is definitely interesting. So, Dad, do you want to give us just a synopsis of the base story like you've been doing through these episodes that people get an idea?
This one's a lot different. Again, I think it's really important to keep in mind that this happens at sort of like the high period of the reign of the High King Peter. So Peter does not make an appearance in this book because he is out subduing the giants to the north, which you get an allusion to having happened
in Silverchair.
Yeah. And so one of the things I do like about this book, even though it doesn't necessarily fit so tightly in with theological themes to, say, Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe or something like that, is just how well, how many allusions you get that tie into the rest of the story and stories.
I feel like he's built out the world by this point in a more substantial way than we've had in the earlier books.
Right. So I think if the time of Peter the High King is the high point of Narnia and the time that people in future centuries, like in the time of Prince Caspian, tell stories about, this would be one of the stories that were told just about the general happenings of that time. So basically what happens is you're introduced to a character, Shasta, who basically is the son of a poor fisherman, and he's very mistreated in his house. He's so mistreated that essentially a knight comes along and stays in the house and notices that he's treated like a slave and offers to buy him from the father. At this point, he concocts a plan to kind of run away, and in his process of running away, he finds out that the knight's horse is a talking horse.
Yeah.
And he's quite surprised by this because in his land, horses don't talk. And not only is he a talking horse, but he's a war horse, and he sort of refers to himself more as like a princely horse.
Yeah.
You know, and this becomes one of his one of Bree's problems throughout the whole
book. A very self-important horse.
Book. So he's got a very high sense of himself. And anyway, they sort of merge their two plans. Bree would like to run away and to get back to Narnia. Bree explains that he did something his mother told him not to do when he was young and explored too far south and got captured and has been captured ever since. As they're running away, pretty quickly after they're running away, they start to get chased by what they think are lions, plural.
Yes.
But it's really just Aslan. And
driving them towards some other people due from Narnia.
Toward a girl named Erebus and a horse named Wynne, who is a mare, so a female horse. Much smaller, more sort of, you get the sense she's much more diminutive than Bree. But also a talking horse of Narnia. Kind of same story, like captured, having been a little bit too far south. And then the rest of the story is about Arvis is trying to escape too because her father is marrying her off to a much, much older man. I think the scene where
she said like 60 with a hunchback,
where you find out how old he is pretty like, oh. And one of the other funny scenes is that the boy who's running away, his name is Shasta. Later you find out his name is Cor, but through most 90-some% of the book, his name is Shasta. Erebus are about the same age. It seems like they're about 12, probably. Does that sound?
Yeah, somewhere between 12 and 14 seemed about right.
And Shasta is shocked that she would be getting married. Like, she's young enough that when he thinks they're the same age and when he finds out her father is marrying her off, he thinks this is a pretty bad thing to be married off when you're her age. And her husband is the royal vizier, who's sort of like the, I don't know, the
prime minister.
Prime minister, yeah. Go-to guy for the king. And so they kind of escape together. Pretty quickly, they enter in, what's the name of the big town? They enter into the, I can't believe I don't remember.
Tashban.
Yeah. Tashban, right?
Tashban. They enter into this town, and quite quickly, Edmund and Susan, or is it just Edmund? Edmund and people of Narnia come by in a parade, and as Shasta's trying to, like, hide, because he doesn't want to be caught with his horse and everything, as he's trying to hide, Edmund recognizes him and thinks that he is the prince of Arkenland that's traveled down with the Narnians. Because Susan is entertaining the idea of marrying the prince of this land. I mean, at this point, the way I'm describing it, it just sounds like a soap opera. So Edmund grabs him up, and he gets separated from the rest of his crew. I mean, I don't want to do too much more of that, but that's a pretty good like intro to sort of the direction of the story,
yeah,
I think.
I think that's true, and... Everything else
I do want people to read it, and I do think this is one that even if people are familiar with Narnia, they probably haven't read this one if they've not read all seven books intentionally.
Yeah, I think that that is probably true. You have an active Aslan in this book, but he doesn't speak till the end. So that we do usually have Aslan in sort of two ways through after the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Either directing the story immediately at the beginning, right, or sort of like chasing and following along and then telling you his purpose at the end of this. And that seems to fall into that second camp where Aslan is actually the driving force. He's the moving force, but he doesn't tell you his purposes until the end.
Yeah, there's a scene when Shasta escapes... So when Edmund grabs him up, he takes him to Susan, and Susan's like, "Oh, my dear prince, I missed you so much." And then they go off because they find out that, or they kind of surmise that if Susan tells the prince Rabadash that she doesn't want to marry him, that it's going to go poorly for them, and so they concoct a plan to host them on their ship for a meal, and they all go away, and Shasta's left alone in the room, and the actual prince
shows up.
Corrin, right?
Corrin
shows up, and then Shasta escapes. But anyway, he goes into a graveyard, and this is sort of one of the big sort of second appearance of Aslan. He goes into a graveyard, and he's scared, and there are essentially hounds that are howling at the gate, and they're going to come eat him. And he meets a cat there. And then as he's sleeping, the cat turns into a lion. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of your other appearance of Aslan where he's not talking. But later on, towards the end of the book, I think it's kind of cool for people that don't always recognize sort of the presence, the way God appears to them in their life, usually by other people, right? Mm-hmm. Aslan explains to him that there was not lions, there was a lion, and it was me. I was the cat.
To Bree. Well, and he explains to Bree. One of the funniest moments of the book is at the end, where Bree is talking to the girls about Aslan, and they go, "Is he a real lion?" And he goes, "No. The lion thing's just a metaphor. He's strong like a lion, and he's fierce in battle like a lion, and he's regal like a lion." But he's not a real lion. And the whole time he's saying this, they're like struck in fear staring behind him because Aslan is like quietly walking up behind him.
I wrote down a line from that scene that I thought was really important because it was the most sort of anti-Gnostic thing you could read in a long time in Lewis. He says, "If he were a lion, he'd be a beast like the rest of us."
Yes.
And I thought, oh, how much do the Gnostics say? If he were a man, he'd be just like the rest of us.
And then when Aslan shows up, he goes, "I am a beast.
I am a beast. Yeah. I am a man." So, anyway.
This one also doubles down on that Aslan is to be feared.
Yep.
That he might hurt you.
Yeah, so you get that line again that he's not tame.
And that seems to be the theme. I think if there was a theological theme tied to Aslan this time, I'd have a hard time saying it's not necessity. That he really is the one he's the driving force behind these events moving forward. It's not by chance.
Divine providence, right?
Yeah, I think that's what I like the idea of calling it necessity, but I think it is, it's providence. As Lewis wrote it, it's probably providence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's the idea that God directs all things to the good for those that love him, right?
Was it when Shasta on some sort of mountaintop or top of a hill, and Aslan's recounting about how he's directed all the events in his life to lead to this moment? And
Aslan saved him as the baby.
I was the one that pushed the boat so that the fishermen would find you. It was always me. And I thought that was pretty great. You get some other themes in here that I think are pretty good too. You know, one of the things I like is that Shasta has, when Shasta finds out he's really the prince of Arkenland, he's the oldest of the two twins. He has to learn everything, and it's a new convert story, right? And it's real daunting to him. He has to learn everything. He even says,
there's a recurring phrase that it's going to be hard to.
He's like, I'm going to have to go to school and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? he looks at Erebus and he says, oh, my goodness. I have to learn everything from scratch. There was another great line that I just loved. So Erebus is the female character the same age as him that's escaping. And they just argue the whole time. And towards the end, Lewis, the narrator, notes that they get married. And he's like, because though they argued much, they made up much. And since they argued much, it seemed rather convenient to just marry her. And I was like, who else are you going to marry? Oh, that was great. Not from my own history or anything.
Wow. So we have another interesting point. So during the time of Caspian and the Dawn Treader, one of the notes is that there's not a lot of men in Narnia left. And here the events mostly occur between men.
Yeah, and you get the sense that there are, at this point in time, a lot of men around, like people.
Even on Peter's side of things. So they describe that Peter's army has many knights riding horses.
Yeah. Well, even in the initial parade of Narnians that recognize Shasta, there's 10 Narnians men there. And, you know, in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, there's not 10 Narnian men, there's the Pevensey children. It does
Where did these men come from?
Yeah, it does kind of beg the question, where did these humans come from? So, I don't know.
It seems like he might be kind of changing his mind about the degrees of some of this in order to sort of drive some stories. There's also places which aren't Narnia, but men might be fighting. So, I guess all the islands that Peter sails to, those are inhabited by men. Narnia rules over them, but they aren't on the mainland of Narnia. And Archenland, too, is inhabited by men, but is the border. It's not Narnia.
Yeah. Well, and if the Voyage of the Dawn Treader plays out and you kind of extrapolate from that, everybody that's a man in this world would have had to come from our land at some point.
Yeah.
Through one of the connection points.
So,
which would make... You know, I guess that makes sense in the reality that you can recognize various cultures from Earth in these cultures.
Yeah.
That he presents.
Now, that's a tension point for other people who have commented on these books. So, the comparison throughout the books is that Carloman and Narnia are very different. And, in fact, it is Narnia that's superior in every way, essentially.
Narnia
in the North.
Constant refrain throughout the book.
Yes. Yeah. and some have suggested that this demonstrated a racism that Lewis possessed for, Turks, Middle Eastern people.
I don't ever think it's fair to call a guy that operated in the 40s and 50s in Oxford, in England, like racist in the same way that we would use it now. I mean, I always feel like there's no compassion for somebody that was a person of their own time. And honestly, if you read the rest of Lewis, held no, wouldn't have never held back meaning or value or the gospel from any person. No matter their race, creed, color, or whatever. But at the same time is writing as a person who's, he's a British person, influenced by a classical education at one of the oldest universities on the planet that is in the West. And also sort of like Adam said, setting as the stage for this world, sort of like what he considers from his own sort of educational experience, an easy time, an exciting time to write about, which is the High Middle Ages, which would have pit
the Turk against the European
cultures
Christian.
Against each other.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's not that hard for me to get out of racism from this.
I don't remember where it is because it's years ago, but I remember reading something. It was on sort of like this Islam in the West theme back when I did that stuff, back when I read books and things. And did scholarly sort of stuff. And the accusation was that Lewis wasn't a racist, but the term is a very specific term used. He's an Orientalist, which is a, if you know the name Edward Said, he was at Columbia University. He was some way connected to President Obama, actually. I think he was one of Obama's teachers, part of that whole post-colonial critical theory, critical pedagogy crowd. And what they mean by Orientalists is Western authors who unwittingly describe the East, in particular Muslim-majority lands, as backwards and mysterious and violent, barbaric, something like that. They do it unwittingly, but they do it to kind of justify the reader's minds, the superiority of the West.
You know, what's interesting to me is, as I was reading it, it seemed more like it was about a Christian culture versus a non-Christian land, yeah. Right? So it's like, of course that's going to look like maybe some of the differences between the West and the Near East, right? Because in our world, the Near East is not majority Christian at all. That culture has been shaped in a very different way by its religious roots, and the West has a religious history that is.
You mean it's been shaped by when it was violently conquered by Muslims?
Yeah.
Is that right. What you're trying to say?
That's exactly what I'm trying to say.
I just want to interrupt. I'm with Scott. I think you said you're impatient with this. The way this is so common now. It's been common for decades. Just people can't read literature or scholars for the sake of reading literature or learning from the scholars. Everything is read with it's okay to read critically, of course, but it's like everything is problematized. Mm-hmm. Everybody goes hunting for racism and colonialism and all these other isms. And like, I don't know who's more impatient, Scott, you or I, but I tend to think I'm impatient.
I just don't know what kind of story is representative of the human condition and human experience that doesn't include tension between different cultures. I mean, and especially cultures that are in described at war. Okay. Yeah. And if you have an enemy, maybe the first thing you're not going to do is sing their praises about how great everything in their society is.
Well, I don't.
Unless you're a postmodernist critical theorist American.
I don't even think that he described Tashban as backwards. He actually, when he notes things, he just notes the differences. He says they don't eat those kind of meals in Narnia. Right? And especially when Shasta is eating sort of food from the north, it's Shasta who's like, I've never had any of this before.
Butter's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, but he also doesn't speak necessarily badly of the food that they eat in the South, and you don't get the impression at all that Tashban is weaker compared to Narnia. The one thing you do get the impression is, which is an interesting juxtaposition to the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, that Narnia and Arkenland are much more seafaring countries than Tashban is. because they do point out that if they can get onto their galleon and get sailing, that they've got nothing in Tashban that can match the speed and the size and the powerfulness of their galleon, the Narnian galleon. But I don't know. I just get annoyed by this. I mean, how, if he's setting a story in sort of the high Middle Ages, if he's describing people that he's sort of describing as Turkish, I would assume in some way, how is he going to describe them?
The interesting thing with Lewis is, you know, I think we talked about this several episodes ago. You know, we brought up this term he used, chronological snobbery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not only is Lewis opposed to sort of imposing your assumptions on texts and assuming your assumptions about what is good, true, and beautiful are the standards, but he is also, you get a sense that Lewis really understands that culture, whether it's British or Chinese or anything in between, is in many ways a construct. That is, human beings create culture.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's good and bad in all cultures.
Yes.
And there's degrees of that too. So, I mean, I've not read as much of Lewis as you have, Scott, but what I get now that I'm trying to to catch up to you is that Lewis is pretty aloof of any sort of cultural criticism.
He's not
a polemicist in that way.
No, I don't think so.
I just think our commentary today, as you pointed out, Adam, would see somebody not condemning the past and images from the past explicitly as being implicitly racist or implicitly sexist, because you're celebrating the past. You don't share the chronological snobbery that we do. And really, if you're going to talk about the past, you have to first condemn it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I was going to say, if you think of the way that so Bree, the talking horse who's the war horse, is as soon as he's free, right, he starts to try to act like what he thinks a Narnian would act like, right? And he sort of all high and mighty, and you can, you know, if he dips his neck at all, he has to make a, I'm only doing this so that we can get through the city. Of course, I would never hold my head like this in a normal circumstance. And he's real haughty in all of this. And his correction from Aslan is essentially, you're trying to emulate all of the bad things of being a Narnian and not the good things that you are. And he gets chastised for believing that he's better than not only just other people from other lands, but from other horses in general. Mm-hmm. And I actually think maybe I'm reading too much into it there, but I actually think Lewis is presenting an idea that, you know, whether you're from, look at Avarice. She's from
Tashban,
the Lower Lands, and she becomes a princess of Arkenland, or queen of Arkenland. Mm-hmm. And I think he's just telling a story.
That's it. He's telling a story.
But he said their skin is brown.
I don't know. I
guess. You know, like, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's, yeah. It is interesting, especially when one of the points of the story that becomes explicit is that is like self-arrogance is a problem.
Yeah, Avarice faces that. She was a person of importance before she escaped, and she had a servant. And part of her escape was essentially to drug her lady servant. Mm-hmm. So that she would fall asleep. And at one point the question is asked, you know, what do you think happened to your lady servant when she woke up and found you were gone? And she said, well, I'm sure she was beaten, but good, because I didn't like her anyway. She was always a spy for my father anyway. So good. I'm glad she's beaten. Later on, when they're being chased again, Aslan is chasing them to try to get them to go faster so that they can warn Arkenland that the prince of Tashban is coming to invade, and they're not going fast enough. They're not driving themselves hard enough. Yeah. So Aslan, as the lion, starts chasing them. And as he's chasing them, he actually catches up to Wynn and Avarice and scratches Avarice's back.
Yeah.
And later on, I just actually thought it was kind of
kind tells of, her it's for every lash yeah, that the you, servant received.
You received lash for lash what your servant received. But he tells her you received ones that were much lighter, you know, that weren't intended to actually hurt you. And it humbles her. And I thought...
That brings in...
I don't mind that story.
another phrase that reoccurs through the last two chapters, which I liked. That is, as she then asked what happened to the servant.
Yeah.
And Aslan said, that's somebody else's story.
That's somebody else's story.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
You know, don't spend your time fretting over somebody else's story. The same thing happens when...
Well, Kor is telling the story at the end. He stops. He goes, but I suppose Aslan would say
the rest
of that is somebody else's story.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. That's sort of both an anti-gossip and sort of worry about what God has put before you more than you worry about what he's put before other people.
Yeah, and I kind of like that. Dealing with, I do think one of the greatest attacks against people's faith actually comes out of good intentions, which can be sort of pity or worry for the condition of other people's souls.
Right. Yeah.
And to the point where it will rattle their own faith, right? Where you think about, you know, maybe the death of an unbeliever that seems unjust, and their seeming fate, according to Scripture, shakes your own foundations for your belief because it all seems unjust.
Yeah, worry about your story. That's mm-hmm. their story. Worry about what Aslan is saying to you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, I thought that was good. So should we tell them how the story ends? Are they supposed to read it?
Oh, you might as well sum it up a little bit. I mean...
Well, after they sort of get out of the city, they find out that the prince is planning to... The Prince Rabadash is planning to invade Arkenland, which is where Shasta is really from, as sort of... in order to get a foothold to eventually invade Narnia, because his end goal is because he's a teenager with you know, who's been pushed aside by his great love Susan. His end goal is to get Susan back
And force her hand into marriage,
and then treat her. And he even actually states this, but then treat her very badly because I'm going to make her marry me, but then I'm going to treat her very badly after I do. And so he puts together an army, and they march north as the sort of the foursome of Shasta, Averest, Wynn, and Bree head north. They try to take a route that they're not sure is faster. But they think it's better to get there first. Anyway, like I said, they're not going fast enough. Aslan drives them faster. They get there, and they get to the house of basically, I think you'd call him a priest, Adam. Would you call him a priest?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think
best description, yeah, that's probably the best way to describe it. Yeah.
I mean, I think in the story, he's probably closer to a wizard.
Well, you know, the image I had in my head reading is the, like, Merlin.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. He's kind of a seer. He,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Magician, something like that.
What is his name? I forgot.
Well.
Anyway, they get to his house, and basically dresses Avarice's wounds and sort of takes care of them and lets them rest. It's a weird, important point to note that at one point, to make the horses look a little more common, they cut Bree's tail short.
His regal tail,
his war horse tail, they cut short to make him try to look like a more common horse, which never really worked anyway. Everybody that saw him was like, wait a minute.
That horse is a little too muscular.
That horse is a little much for that little boy. Shasta keeps going, basically, and he tries and does make it all the way into Arkenland, where it's... And he gives his warning. And there he meets Corin, who he had already met down in Tashban, who's his twin brother. And they see that they really are twins. And he he makes his way to King Loon, who's his father. And what you find out eventually is that Shasta Corrin is really the prince, that the prince of Arkenland were twins, and that Shasta is the oldest, and that the kingdom will be his. But the funny thing is if you go back to sort of the wizard's little cabin, there's this ongoing discussion about, well, should they get going to go to go do what they were going to do and make it into Narnia and the whole nine yards. And Bree keeps holding them up from not going. And eventually you find out that Bree doesn't want to continue because Bree doesn't think he can present himself as a Narnian horse because he looks so shabby and he doesn't know if he's talking in the right way. He doesn't know if Narnian horses roll on the ground to scratch their back, you know, and his tail has been cut, and he gets called out on this. He gets called out on this by Avarice and Wynn, and then eventually gets called out on it by the magician or the wizard, and then he eventually gets called out on it by Aslan, which I think in a kid's storybook is kind of a cool way to sort of deal with
vanity, narcissism.
Yeah. I actually think in a kid's storybook, it's a pretty clever way to handle that kind of thing.
The vanity in this isn't totally meaningless either. So it addresses a particular type, which is the sort of longing to belong. So, and then,
well, and not knowing quite what it is going to take to belong or to be recognized as,
Then speculating
one of the cool horses in Narnia.
So it's sort of, you know, in a sense, not really having the word and then making yourself the key. Right. So if you don't know what it takes to be a Narnian, if you don't know what it takes to be a Christian, to be in that community, then you start speculating and making it up, and it must have something to do with how good, great, beautiful you are.
Yes.
Yeah. One of my favorite parts of the book was the battle scene. It was, in essence, really the most written out battle that we've had in one of these books. So in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, there's battle. But, you know, comparative...
Prince Caspian, there's the battle where Peter challenges the uncle.
Right. But even that is so much shorter, you know. This was several pages, and it was all described from the outside of the battle.
Yes, because the wizard is looking at it. Mm-hmm. That was actually pretty cool. The wizard's looking at it through... It's not a crystal ball, but it's like
his lake.
His lake, and he can see, but he can't hear.
So he's
and
got so, shot for shot.
Yeah, so he's doing like they do, you know, like those guys do on a football game. So they're kind of giving you play by play.
Yeah, it was play by play, and it's really cool. I thought it was very well written. I love, you know, watching in my head really Edmund sort of like strike down these warlords one at a time. He's just like a machine.
Yeah, like a Leonidas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It made me think again after I said, you know, I really wish Silver Chair was adapted to film because of how colorful and how many scene changes.
This would make a great film adaptation.
Oh, my gosh,
I should think it would.
This last battle would actually make more sense than it did in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe movie because that battle ends very quickly in that book. Yeah. Aslan comes and decisively wins that. They actually kind of draw it out in the movie a little more. In this, though, it's a battle with descriptors of, like, the Narnian cats, like the leopards coming in and, like, attacking horses and then jumping up on the gates and things. It was all very well-crafted little battle scene.
No, I thought it was great. Did anybody else notice the fact that I think it's Lucy or Susan, I don't remember, makes a note that when they last were in Narnia, the moles were just planting the orchard, which is, I believe, the orchard that they come into when they're called back in 1,000 years later in Prince Caspian. Yes. And I just thought, oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
That's why I don't write novels. I wouldn't think of doing that kind of thing. So I liked it. I think it's a fun one. It's a little less, on the whole, it's a little less serious, like theologically serious than the rest of them. But it's a good sort of example, like Adam said, of divine providence. Mm-hmm. It's also sort of a good example of sort of like some moral tales for children told in not an overly moralistic kind of suffocating way.
Yeah. It was pretty good, and it helps. It's going to help fill out the stage in the last battle too, when we get there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So it's definitely good for that. Again, for sort of building that world. So, any last thoughts, Adam, before we go?
No, I'm just trying to think what's next. Is it Magician's Nephew?
Magician's Nephew.
And then the last battle. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Fast paced. Magician's Nephew, I had forgotten as I started getting back into it how fast paced it is.
Like, well, and it's the shortest too, isn't it?
Hold on to your hats.
Hold on to
you've been seeing.
Yeah.
So the creation tale is coming, and then you get the Eschaton.
That's not that it's that episode yet, but that's fitting given how quickly creation story happens in the Bible.
In some ways, there's more detail in the Magician's Nephew than in the Bible. But the way that Lewis presents creation in the Magician's Nephew actually helps me with first three chapters of Genesis.
Interesting. Hmm. Well, cool. Well, that'll be a fun episode to do.
Very interesting. Yeah.
Well, great. Thank you for joining us as we've been reading through this. And as always, if this is your first time listening and maybe you haven't read the book, but you are encouraged to, and you maybe want to go back and listen to the rest of our series on this, you can find it at the 1517 website or in your favorite podcasting app. If you subscribe to the Thinking Fellows in a podcasting app like Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Spotify, it'll show up every Tuesday morning. All right, guys. Thank you for listening. We will catch you next week. Bye.